she retrieved her coat from him and hung it up. While he'd been holding it, he had seemed entirely taken up with this task and oblivious to anything else. Without it, he seemed a little lost and naked, and was forced to stir himself back into life. He turned his big, heavy eyes back on Richard. "Richard," he said, I read your piece in Fathom on music and..." "Fractal landscape," said Richard shortly. He didn't want to talk to Michael, and he certainly didn't want to get drawn into a conversation about Michael's wretched magazine, or rather, the magazine that used to be Michael's. That was the precise aspect of the conversation that Richard didn't want to get drawn into. Yes, very interesting, of course," said Michael in his silky, over-rounded voice. "Mountain shapes and tree shapes and all sorts of things. Recycled algae. Recursive algorithms. Yes, of course, very interesting, but so wrong, so terribly wrong. For the magazine, I mean. It is, after all, an arts review. I would never have allowed such a thing, of course. Ross has utterly ruined it. Utterly. He'll have to go. Have to. He has no sensibilities and is a thief." "He's not a thief, Wednesday. That's absolutely absurd," snapped Richard, instantly getting drawn into it in spite of his resolution not to. "He had nothing to do with your getting the push whatsoever. That was your own silly fault, and you..." There was a sharp intake of breath. "Richard," said Michael in his softest, quietest voice. Arguing with him was like getting tangled in parachute silk. "I think you do not understand how important..." "Michael," said Susan, gently but firmly, holding open the door. Michael Wenton Weeks nodded faintly and seemed to deflate. "Your book," Susan added, holding out to him a small and elderly volume on the ecclesiastical architecture of Kent. He took it, murmured some slight thanks, looked about him for a moment as if he'd suddenly realized something rather odd, then gathered himself together, nodded farewell, and left. Richard didn't appreciate quite how tense he had become till Michael left and he was suddenly able to relax. He'd always resented the indulgent soft spot that Susan had for Michael, even if she did try to disguise it by being terribly rude to him all the time, perhaps even because of that. "Susan, what can I say?" he started lamely. "You could say ouch for a start. You didn't even give me that satisfaction when I hit you, and I thought I did it rather hard. God, it's freezing in here. What's that window doing wide open?" She went over to shut it. "I told you, that's how I got in," said Richard. He sounded sufficiently as if he meant it to make her look around at him in surprise. "Really," he said, "like in the chocolate ads, only I forgot the box of chocolates." He shrugged sheepishly. She stared at him in amazement. "What on earth possessed you to do that?" she said. She stuck her head out of the window and looked down. "You could have got killed," she said, turning back to him. "Well, yes," he said. "It just seemed the only way to, I don't know." He ran at himself. "You took your key back, remember?" "Yes, I got fed up with you coming and raiding my larder when you couldn't be bothered to do your own shopping. Richard, you really climbed up this wall?" "Well, I wanted to be here when you got in." She shook her head in bewilderment. "It would have been a great deal better if you'd been here when I went out. Is that why you're wearing those filthy old clothes?" "Yes. You don't think I went to dinner at St. Sed's like this?" "Well, I no longer know what you consider to be rational behaviour." She sighed and fished about in a small drawer. "Here," she said, "if it's going to save your life," and handed him a couple of keys on a ring. "I'm too tired to be angry anymore. An evening of being lobbied by Michael has taken it out of me." "Well, I'll never understand why you put up with him," said Richard, going to fetch the coffee. "I know you don't like him, but he's very sweet and can be charming in his sad kind of way. Usually it's very relaxing to be with someone who's so self-absorbed, because it doesn't make any demands on you. But he's obsessed with the idea that I can do something about his magazine. I can't, of course. Life doesn't work like that. I do feel sorry for him, though." "I don't. He's had it very, very easy all his life. He still has it very, very easy. He's just had his toy taken away from him, that's all. It's hardly unjust, is it?" "It's not a matter of whether it's just or not. I feel sorry for him because he's unhappy." "Well, of course he's unhappy. Al Ross has turned Fathom into a really sharp, intelligent magazine that everyone suddenly wants to read. It was just a bumbling shambles before. His only real function was to let Michael have lunch and toady about with whoever he liked on the pretext that maybe they might like to write a little something. He hardly ever got an actual issue out. The whole thing was a sham. He pampered himself with it. I really don't find that charming or engaging. I'm sorry, I'm going on about it, and I didn't mean to." Susan shrugged uneasily. "I think you overreact," she said, "though I think I will have to steer clear of him if he's going to keep on at me to do something I simply can't do. It's too exhausting. Anyway, listen, I'm glad you had a lousy evening. I want to talk about what we were going to do this weekend." "Ah," said Richard. "Well, oh," said Susan, "I better just check the messages first." She walked past him to the telephone answering machine, played the first few seconds of Gordon's message, and then suddenly ejected the cassette. "I can't be bothered," she said, giving it to him. "Could you just give this straight to Susan at the office tomorrow? Save her a trip. If there's anything important on it, she can tell me." Richard blinked and said, Yes, and pocketed the tape, tingling with the shock of the reprieve. Anyway, the weekend, said Susan, sitting down on the sofa. Richard wiped his hand over his brow. Susan, I'm afraid I've got to work, she said. Nicola's sick, and I'm going to have to dep for her at the Wigmore on Friday week. There's some Vivaldi and some Mozart I don't know too well, so that means a lot of extra practice this weekend, I'm afraid. Sorry. Well, in fact, said Richard, I have to work as well. He sat down by her. I know. Gordon keeps on at me to nag you. I wish he wouldn't. It's none of my business, and it puts me in an invidious position. I'm tired of being pressurized by people, Richard. At least you don't do that. She took a sip of her coffee. But I'm sure, she added, that there's some kind of grey area between being pressurized and being completely forgotten about that I'd quite like to explore. Oh, give me a hug. He hugged her, feeling that he was monstrously and unworthily lucky. An hour later, he let himself out and discovered that Pizza Express was closed. Meanwhile, Michael Wenton Weeks made his way back to his home in Chelsea. As he sat in the back of the taxi, he watched the streets with a blank stare and tapped his fingers lightly against the window in a slow, thoughtful rhythm. Rap-tap-tap-a-rap-tap-a-rap-a-tap. He was one of those dangerous people who are soft, squidgy, and cow-like, provided they have what they want. And because he had always had what he wanted, and had seemed easily pleased with it, it had never occurred to anybody that he was anything other than soft, squidgy, and cow-like. You would have to push through a lot of soft, squidgy bits in order to find a bit that didn't give when you pushed it. That was the bit that all of the soft, squidgy bits were there to protect. Michael Wenton Weeks was the younger son of Lord Magna, publisher, newspaper owner, and overindulgent father, under whose protective umbrella it had pleased Michael to run his own little magazine at a magnificent loss. Lord Magna had presided over the gradual but dignified and well-respected decline of the publishing empire originally founded by his father, the first Lord Magna. Michael continued to tap his knuckles lightly on the glass. A rap, tap, a rap, a tap. He remembered the appalling, terrible day when his father had electrocuted himself changing a plug, and his mother, took over the business. Not only took it over, but started running it with completely unexpected verve and determination. She examined the company with a very sharp eye as to how it was being run, or walked, as she put it, and eventually even got around to looking at the accounts of Michael's magazine. Tap, tap, tap. Now, Michael knew just enough about the business side of things to know what the figures ought to be, and he had simply assured his father that that was indeed what they were. Can't allow this job just to be a sinecure. You must see that, old fellow. You have to pay your way, or how would it look? How would it be? His father used to say. And Michael would nod seriously and start thinking out the figures for next month, or whenever it was he would next manage to get an issue out. His mother, on the other hand, was not so indulgent. Not by a lorry load. Michael usually referred to his mother as an old battle axe, but if she was fairly to be compared to a battle axe, it would only be to an exquisitely crafted, beautifully balanced battle axe with an elegant minimum of fine engraving which stopped just short of its gleaming razored edge. One swipe from such an instrument, and you wouldn't even know you'd been hit until you tried to look at your watch a little later and discovered that your arm wasn't on. She had been waiting patiently, or at least with the appearance of patience, in the wings all this time, being the devoted wife, the doting but strict mother. Now someone had taken her, to switch metaphors for a moment, out of her scabbard, and everyone was running for cover, including Michael. It was her firm belief that Michael, whom she quietly adored, had been spoiled, in the fullest and worst sense of the word, and she was determined at this late stage to stop it. It didn't take her more than a few minutes to see that he had simply been making up the figures every month, and that the magazine was hemorrhaging money as Michael toyed with it, all the time running up huge lunch bills, taxi accounts, and staff costs that he would playfully set against fictitious taxes. The whole thing had simply got lost somewhere in the gargantuan accounts of Magna House. She had then summoned Michael to see her. Tap, tap, tap-a-rap-a-tap, tap, tap. How do you want me to treat you, she said. As my son, or as the editor of one of my magazines? I'm happy to do either. Your magazines? Well, I am your son, but I don't see... Right, Michael, I want you to look at these figures, she said, briskly, handing over a sheet of computer printout. The ones on the left show the actual incomings and outgoings of Fathom. The ones on the right are your own figures. Does anything strike you about them? Mother, I can explain. Good, said Lady Magna sweetly. I'm very glad of that. She took the piece of paper back. Now, do you have any views on how the magazine should best be run in the future? Yes, absolutely. Very strong ones. Good, said Lady Magna with a bright smile. Well, that's all perfectly satisfactory, then. Don't you want to hear? No, that's all right, dear. I'm just happy to know that you do have something to say on the matter to clear it all up. I'm sure the new owner of Fathom will be glad to listen to whatever it is. What? Said a stunned Michael. You mean you're actually selling Fathom? No, I mean I've already sold it. Didn't get much for it, I'm afraid. £1 plus a promise that you would be retained as the editor for the next 3 issues, and after that it's at the new owner's discretion. Michael stared, pop-eyed. Well, come now, said his mother reasonably. We could hardly continue under the present arrangement, could we? You always agreed with your father that the job should not be a sinecure for you, and since I would have a great deal of difficulty in either believing or resisting your stories, I thought I would hand the problem on to someone with whom you could have a more objective relationship. Now, I have another appointment, Michael.
Well, but who have you sold it to? Spluttered Michael.
Gordon Way.
Gordon Way? But for heaven's sake, Mother,
He's very anxious to be seen to patronise the arts, and I think I do mean patronise. I'm sure you'll get on splendidly, dear. Now, if you don't mind... Michael stood his ground.
I've never heard of anything so outrageous.
Do you know, that's exactly what Mr. Way said when I showed him these figures and then demanded that you be kept on as editor for 3 issues. Michael huffed and puffed and went red and wagged his finger, but could think of nothing more to say, except... What difference would it have made to all this if I'd said treat me as the editor of one of your magazines? Why, dear, said Lady Magna with her sweetest smile, I would have called you Mr. Wenton Weeks, of course, and I wouldn't now be telling you to straighten your tie, she added, with a tiny little gesture under her chin. Rap, tap, tap, rap, tap, tap. Number 17, was it, Gov? What? Said Michael, shaking his head. It was 17, you said, was it? Said the cab driver. 'Cause we're here. Yes, thank you, said Michael. He climbed out and fumbled in his pocket for some money. Tap, 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 eh? What? Said Michael, handing over the fare. Tap, 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 said the cab driver, all the bloody way here. Got something on your mind, eh, mate?
Mind your own bloody business, snapped Michael savagely.
Oh, if you say so, mate. Just thought you might be going mad or something, said the cabbie, and drove off. Michael let himself into his house and walked through the cold hall to the dining room. Turned on the overhead light, and poured himself a brandy from the decanter. He took off his coat, threw it across the large mahogany dining table, and pulled a chair over to the window, where he sat nursing his drink and his grievances. Tap, 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 he went on the window. He had sullenly remained as editor for the stipulated 3 issues, and was then, with little ceremony, let go. A new editor was found, a certain A. K. Ross, who was young, hungry, and ambitious, and he quickly turned the magazine into a resounding success. Michael, in the meantime, had been lost and naked. There was nothing else for him. He tapped on the window again and looked, as he frequently did, at the small table lamp that stood on the sill. It was a rather ugly, ordinary little lamp, and the only thing about it that regularly transfixed his attention was that this was the lamp that had electrocuted his father, and this was where he had been sitting. The old boy was such a fool with anything technical. Michael could just see him peering with profound concentration through his half-moons and sucking his moustache as he tried to unravel the arcane complexities of a 13-amp plug. He had, it seemed, plugged it back in the wall without first screwing the cover back on, and then tried to change the fuse in situ. From this he received the shock which had stilled his already dicky heart. Such a simple, simple error, thought Michael, such as anyone could have made, anyone, but the consequences of it were catastrophic. Utterly catastrophic. His father's death, his own loss, the rise of the appalling Ross and his disastrously successful magazine, and... Tap, tap, tap. He looked at the window, at his own reflection, and at the dark shadows of the bushes on the other side of it. He looked again at the lamp. This was the very object, this the very place, and the error was such a simple one. Simple to make, simple to prevent. The only thing that separated him from that simple moment was the invisible barrier of the months that had passed in between. A sudden, odd calm descended on him, as if something inside him had suddenly been resolved. Tap, tap, tap. Fathom was his. It wasn't meant to be a success. It was his life. His life had been taken from him, and that demanded a response. Tap, tap, tap. Crack! He surprised himself by suddenly punching his hand through the window and cutting himself quite badly. Chapter 15. Some of the less pleasant aspects of being dead were beginning to creep up on Gordon Way as he stood in front of his cottage. It was, in fact, a rather large house by anybody else's standards, but he had always wanted to have a cottage in the country, and so when the time came for him finally to buy one, and he discovered that he had rather more money available than he had ever seriously believed he might own, he bought a large old rectory and called it a cottage, in spite of its 7 bedrooms and its 4 acres of dank Cambridgeshire land. This did little to endear him to people who only had cottages. But then, if Gordon Way had allowed his actions to be governed by what endeared him to other people, he wouldn't have been Gordon Way. He wasn't, of course, Gordon Way any longer. He was the ghost of Gordon Way. In his pocket, he had the ghosts of Gordon Way's keys. It was this realization that had stopped him for a moment in his invisible tracks. The idea of walking through walls, frankly, revolted him. It was something he had been trying strenuously to avoid all night. He had instead been fighting to grip and grapple with every object he touched, in order to render it, and thereby himself, substantial. To enter his house, his own house, by any means other than that of opening the front door and striding in a proprietorial manner, filled him with a hurtling sense of loss. He wished, as he stared at it, that the house was not such an extreme example of Victorian Gothic, and that the moonlight didn't play so coldly on its narrow gabled windows and its forbidding turrets. He had joked stupidly when he bought it that it looked as if it ought to be haunted, not realizing that one day it would be, or by whom. A chill of the spirit gripped him as he made his way silently up the driveway, lined by the looming shapes of yew trees that were far older than the rectory itself. It was a disturbing thought that anybody else might be scared walking up such a driveway on such a night, for fear of meeting something such as him. Behind a screen of yew trees off to his left stood the gloomy bulk of the old church, decaying now, only used in rotation with others in neighbouring villages, and presided over by a vicar who was usually breathless from bicycling there, and dispirited by the few who were waiting for him when he arrived. Behind the steeple of the church hung the cold eye of the moon. A glimpse of movement seemed suddenly to catch his eye, as if a figure had moved in the bushes near the house, but it was, he told himself, only his imagination, overwrought by the strain of being dead. What was there here that he could possibly be afraid of? He continued onwards, around the angle of the wing of the rectory, towards the front door, set deep within its gloomy porch, wreathed in ivy. He was suddenly startled to realise there was light coming from inside the house, electric light and also the dim flicker of firelight. It was a moment or two before he realised that he was, of course, expected that night, though hardly in his present form. Mrs. Bennet, the elderly housekeeper, would have been in to make the bed, light the fire, and leave out a light supper for him. The television, too, would be on, especially so that he could turn it off impatiently upon entering. His footsteps failed to crunch on the gravel as he approached. Though he knew that he must fail at the door, he nevertheless could not but go there first, to try if he could open it, and only then, hidden within the shadows of the porch, would he close his eyes and let himself slip ashamedly through it. He stepped up to the door and stopped. It was open. Just 1/2 inch, but it was open. His spirit fluttered in fearful surprise. How could it be open? Mrs. Bennet was always so conscientious about such things. He stood uncertainly for a moment, and then with difficulty exerted himself against the door. Under the little pressure he could bring to bear on it, it swung slowly and unwillingly open, its hinges groaning in protest. He stepped through and slipped along the stone-flagged hallway. A wide staircase led up into the darkness, but the doors that led off from the hallway all stood closed. The nearest door led into the drawing room, in which the fire was burning, and from which he could hear the muted car chases of the late movie. He struggled futilely for a moment or two with its shiny brass doorknob, but was forced in the end to admit a humiliating defeat, and with a sudden rage flung himself straight at the door and through it. The room inside was a picture of pleasant domestic warmth. He staggered violently into it and was unable to stop himself floating on through a small occasional table set with thick sandwiches and a thermos flask of hot coffee, through a large overstuffed armchair, into the fire, through the thick hot brickwork, and into the cold dark dining room beyond. The connecting door back into the sitting room was also closed. Gordon fingered it numbly and then, submitting himself to the inevitable, braced himself and slid back through it, calmly, gently, noticing for the first time the rich internal grain of the wood. The coziness of the room was almost too much for Gordon, and he wandered distractedly around it, unable to settle, letting the warm liveliness of the firelight play through him. Him it couldn't warm. What, he wondered, were ghosts supposed to do all night? He sat uneasily and watched the television. Soon, however, the car chases drifted peacefully to a close, and there was nothing left but grey snow and white noise, which he was unable to turn off. He found he'd sunk too far into the chair and confused himself with bits of it as he pushed and pulled himself up. He tried to amuse himself by standing in the middle of a table, but it did little to alleviate a mood that was sliding inexorably from despondency downwards. Perhaps he would sleep. Perhaps. He felt no tiredness or drowsiness, but just a deadly craving for oblivion. He passed back through the closed door and into the dark hallway, from which the wide, heavy stairs led to the large, gloomy bedrooms above. Up these, emptily, he trod. It was for nothing, he knew. If you cannot open the door to a bedroom, you cannot sleep in its bed. He slid himself through the door and lifted himself onto the bed, which he knew to be cold, though he could not feel it. The moon seemed unable to leave him alone, and shone full on him as he lay there, wide-eyed and empty, unable now to remember what sleep was or how to do it. The horror of hollowness lay on him, the horror of lying ceaselessly and forever awake at 4 o'clock in the morning. He had nowhere to go, nothing to do when he got there, and no one he could go and wake up who wouldn't be utterly horrified to see him. The worst moment had been when he had seen Richard on the road, Richard's face frozen white in the windscreen. He saw again his face and that of the pale figure next to him. That had been the thing which had shaken out of him the lingering shred of warmth at the back of his mind which said that this was just a temporary problem. It seemed terrible in the night hours, but would be all right in the morning when he could see people and sort things out. He fingered the memory of the moment in his mind and could not let it go. He had seen Richard. And Richard, he knew, had seen him. It was not going to be all right. Usually when he felt this bad at night, he popped downstairs to see what was in the fridge, so he went now. It would be more cheerful than this moonlit bedroom. He would hang around the kitchen, going bump in the night. He slid down and partially through the banisters, wafted through the kitchen door without a second thought, and then devoted all his concentration and energy for about 5 minutes to getting the light switch on. That gave him a real sense of achievement, and he determined to celebrate with a beer. After a moment or two of repeatedly juggling and dropping a can of Foster's, he gave it up. He had not the slightest conception of how he could manage to open a ring pull, and besides, the stuff was all shaken up by now, and what was he going to do with the stuff, even if he could get it open? He didn't have a body to keep it in. He hurled the can away from him, and it scuttled off under a cupboard. He began to notice something about himself, which was the way in which his ability to grasp things seemed to grow and fade in a slow rhythm, as did his visibility. There was an irregularity in the rhythm, though, or perhaps it was just that sometimes the effects of it would be much more pronounced than at others. That, too, seemed to vary according to a slower rhythm. Just at that moment it seemed to him that his strength was on the increase. In a sudden fever of activity, he tried to see how many things in the kitchen he could move or use or somehow get to work. He pulled open cupboards, yanked out drawers, scattering cutlery on the floor. He got a brief whir out of the food processor. He knocked over the electric coffee grinder without getting it to work. He turned on the gas on the cooker hob, but then couldn't light it. He savaged a loaf of bread with a carving knife. He tried stuffing lumps of bread into his mouth, but they simply fell through his mouth to the floor. A mouse appeared, but scurried from the room, its coat electric with fear. Eventually, he stopped and sat on the kitchen table, emotionally exhausted but physically numb. How, he wondered, would people react to his death? Who would be most sorry to know that he had gone? For a while, there would be shock, then sadness. Then they would adjust, and he would be a fading memory as people got on with their own lives without him, thinking that he had gone on to wherever people go. That was a thought that filled him with the most icy dread. He had not gone. He was still here. He sat facing one cupboard that he hadn't managed to open yet because its handle was too stiff, and that annoyed him. He grappled awkwardly with a tin of tomatoes and then went over again to the large cupboard and attacked the handle with the tin. The door flew open, and his own missing, blood-stained body fell horribly forward out of it. Gordon hadn't realized up to this point that it was possible for a ghost to faint. He realized it now and did it. He was woken a couple of hours later by the sound of his gas cooker exploding. Chapter 16. The following morning, Richard woke up twice. The first time, he assumed he'd made a mistake and turned over for a fitful few minutes more. The second time, he sat up with a jolt, as the events of the previous night insisted themselves upon him. He went downstairs and had a moody and unsettled breakfast, during which nothing went right. He burnt the toast, spilt the coffee, and realised that though he'd meant to buy some more marmalade yesterday, he hadn't. He surveyed his feeble attempt at feeding himself and thought that maybe he could at least allow himself the time to take Susan out for an amazing meal tonight to make up for last night, if he could persuade her to come. There was a restaurant that Gordon had been enthusing about at great length and recommending that they try. Gordon was pretty good on restaurants. He certainly seemed to spend enough time in them. He sat and tapped his teeth with a pencil for a couple of minutes, and then went up to his workroom and lugged a telephone directory out from under a pile of computer magazines. L'Esprit d'Escalier. He phoned the restaurant and tried to book a table, but when he said when he wanted it for, this seemed to cause a little amusement. "Ah, non, monsieur," said the maitre d', "I regret that it is impossible. At this moment it is necessary to make reservations at least 3 weeks in advance, pardon, monsieur." Richard marvelled at the idea that there were people who actually knew what they wanted to do 3 weeks in advance, thanked the maitre d' and rang off. Well, maybe a pizza again instead. This thought connected back to the appointment he had failed to keep last night, and after a moment, curiosity overcame him, and he reached for the phone book again. Gentlemen, gentles, gentry. There was no gently at all, not a single one. He found the other directories, except for the Esther Z book, which his cleaning lady continually threw away for reasons he had never yet fathomed. There was certainly no Chelly or anything like it. There was no Gently with a J, no Gently with a DG, no Gently with a DJ, no Gently with a DZ, nor anything remotely similar. He wondered about TJ Entley, TS Entley, or TZ Entley, and tried director inquiries, but they were out. He sat and tapped his teeth with the pencil again, and watched his sofa slowly revolving on the screen of his computer. How very peculiar it had been that it had only been hours earlier that Reg had asked after Dirk with such urgency. If you really wanted to find someone, how would you set about it and what would you do? He tried phoning the police, but they were out too. Well, that was that. He had done all he could do for the moment short of hiring a private detective, and he had better ways of wasting his time and money. He would run into Dirk again, as he did every few years or so. He found it hard to believe that there were really such people, anyway, as private detectives. What sort of people were they? What did they look like? Where did they work? What sort of tie would you wear if you were a private detective? Presumably it would have to be exactly the sort of tie that people wouldn't expect private detectives to wear. Imagine having to sort out a problem like that when you just got up. Just out of curiosity as much as anything else, and because the only alternative was settling down to anthem coding, he found himself leafing through the yellow pages. Private detectives. See detective agencies. The words looked almost odd in such a solid and business-like context. He flipped back through the book. Dry cleaners, dog breeders, dental technicians, detective agencies. At that moment, the phone rang and he answered it, a little curtly. He didn't like being interrupted. "Something wrong, Richard?" "Oh, hi, Kate. Sorry, no, I was... my mind was elsewhere." Kate Anselm was another star programmer at WayForward Technologies. She was working on a long-term artificial intelligence project, the sort of thing that sounded like an absurd pipe dream until you heard her talking about it. Gordon needed to hear her talking about it quite regularly, partly because he was nervous about the money it was costing, and partly because, well, there was little doubt that Gordon liked to hear Kate talking anyway. "I didn't want to disturb you," she said. "It's just I was trying to contact Gordon and can't. There's no reply from London, or the cottage, or his car, or his bleeper. It's just that for someone as obsessively in contact as Gordon, it's a bit odd. You heard he's had a phone put in his isolation tank, true?" I haven't spoken to him since yesterday," said Richard. He suddenly remembered the tape he had taken from Susan's answering machine, and hoped to God there wasn't anything more important in Gordon's message than ravings about rabbits. He said, "I know he was going to the cottage. I don't know where he is. Have you tried?" Richard couldn't even think of anywhere else to try. "Good God!" "Richard? How extraordinary! Richard, what's the matter?" "Nothing, Kate. Just read the most astounding thing." "Really? What are you reading?" "Well, the telephone directory, in fact." "Really? I must rush out and buy one. Have the film rights gone?" "Look, sorry, Kate, can I get back to you? I don't know where Gordon is at the moment, and..." "Don't worry, I know how it is when you can't wait to turn the next page. They always keep you guessing till the end, don't they? It must have been Zbigniew that did it. Have a good weekend." She hung up. Richard hung up too, and sat staring at the box advertisement lying open in front of him in the yellow pages. It said, Dirk Gently's Holistic Detective Agency. We solve the whole crime. We find the whole person. Phone today for the whole solution to your problem. Missing cats and messy divorces a speciality. 33A Peckender Street, London, N1. 01-354-9112. Peckender Street was only a few minutes' walk away. Richard scribbled down the address, pulled on his coat, and trotted downstairs, stopping to make another quick inspection of the sofa. There must, he thought, be something terribly obvious that he was overlooking. The sofa was jammed on a slight turn in the long, narrow stairway. At this point, the stairs were interrupted for a couple of yards of flat landing, which corresponded with the position of the flat directly beneath Richard's. However, his inspection produced no new insights, and he eventually clambered on over it and out of the front door. In Islington, you can hardly hurl a brick without hitting three antique shops, an estate agent, and a bookshop. Even if you didn't actually hit them, you would certainly set off their burglar alarms, which wouldn't be turned off again till after the weekend. A police car played its regular game of dodgems down Upper Street and squealed to a halt just past him. Richard crossed the road behind it. The day was cold and bright, which he liked. He walked across the top of Islington Green, where Winers got beaten up, past the site of the old Collins Music Hall, which had got burnt down, and through Camden Passage, where American tourists get ripped off. He browsed among the antiques for a while and looked at a pair of earrings which he thought Susan would like, but he wasn't sure. Then he wasn't sure that he liked them, got confused, and gave up. He looked in at a bookshop and, on an impulse, bought an anthology of Coleridge's poems, since it was just lying there. From here, he threaded his way through the winding back streets, over the canal, past the council estates that lined the canal, through a number of smaller and smaller squares, till finally he reached Peckender Street, which had turned out to be a good deal further than he thought. It was the sort of street where property developers in large Jaguars drive around at the weekend salivating. It was full of end-of-lease shops, Victorian industrial architecture, and a short decaying late Georgian terrace, all just itching to be pulled down so that sturdy young concrete boxes could sprout in their places. Estate agents roamed the area in hungry packs, eyeing each other warily, their clipboards on a hair trigger. Number 33, when he eventually found it neatly sandwiched between 37 and 45, was in a poorish state of repair, but no worse than most of the rest. The ground floor was a dusty travel agent's whose window was cracked and whose faded BOAC posters were probably now quite valuable. The doorway next to the shop had been painted bright red, not well, but at least recently. A push button next to the door said, in neatly penciled lettering, Dominique, French lessons, troisième floor. The most striking feature of the door, however, was the bold and shiny brass plaque fixed in the dead centre of it, on which was engraved the legend, Dirk Gently's Holistic Detective Agency. Nothing else. It looked brand new. Even the screws that held it in place were still shiny. The door opened to Richard's push, and he peered inside. He saw a short and musty hallway, which contained little but the stairway that led up from it. A door at the back of the hall showed little sign of having been opened in recent years, and had stacks of old metal shelving, a fish tank, and the carcass of a bike piled up against it. Everything else, the walls, the floor, the stairs themselves, and as much of the rear door as could be got at, had been painted grey in an attempt to smarten it up cheaply. But it was now all badly scuffed, and little cups of fungus were peeking from a damp stain near the ceiling. The sounds of angry voices reached him, and, as he started up the stairs, he was able to disentangle the noise of two entirely separate but heated arguments that were going on somewhere above him. One ended abruptly, or at least half of it did, as an angry, overweight man came clattering down the stairs, pulling his raincoat collar straight. The other half of the argument continued in a torrent of aggrieved French from high above them. The man pushed past Richard and said, "Save your money, mate, it's a complete washout," and disappeared out into the chilly morning. The other argument was more muffled. As Richard reached the first corridor, a door slammed somewhere and brought that too to an end. He looked into the nearest open doorway. It led into a small ante-office. The other inner door leading from it was firmly closed. A youngish, plump-faced girl in a cheap blue coat was pulling sticks of makeup and boxes of Kleenex out of her desk drawer and thrusting them into her bag. "Is this the detective agency?" Richard asked her tentatively. The girl nodded, biting her lip and keeping her head down. "And is Mr. Gently in?" "He may be," she said, throwing back her hair, which was too curly for throwing back properly. "And then again, he may not be. I am not in a position to tell. It is not my business to know of his whereabouts. His whereabouts are, as of now, entirely his own business." She retrieved her last pot of nail varnish and tried to slam the drawer shut. A fat book sitting upright in the drawer prevented it from closing. She tried to slam the door again without success. She picked up the book, ripped out a clump of pages, and replaced it. This time she was able to slam the drawer with ease. "Are you his secretary?" asked Richard. "I am his ex-secretary, and I intend to stay that way," she said, firmly snapping her bag shut. "If he intends to spend his money on stupid expensive brass plaques rather than on paying me, then let him. But I won't stay to stand for it, thank you very much. Good for business, my foot. Answering the phones properly is good for business, and I'd like to see his fancy brass plaque do that. If you'll excuse me, I'd like to storm out, please." Richard stood aside, and out she stormed. "And good riddance!" shouted a voice from the inner office. A phone rang and was picked up immediately. "Yes?" answered the voice from the inner office testily. The girl popped back for her scarf, but quietly so her ex-employer wouldn't hear. Then she was finally gone. "Yes, Dirk Gently's Holistic Detective Agency. How can we be of help to you?" The torrent of French from upstairs had ceased. A kind of tense calm descended. Inside, the voice said, "That's right, Mrs. Sunderland. Messy divorces are our particular speciality." There was a pause. "Yes, thank you, Mrs. Sunderland. Not quite that messy." Down went the phone again, to be replaced instantly by the ringing of another one. Richard looked around the grim little office. There was very little in it. A battered chipboard veneer desk, an old grey filing cabinet, and a dark green tin waste paper bin. On the wall was a Duran Duran poster, on which someone had scrawled in fat red felt-tip, "Take this down, please." Beneath that, another hand had scrawled, "No." Beneath that again, the first hand had written, "I insist that you take it down." Beneath that, the second hand had written, "Won't." Beneath that, "You're fired." Beneath that, "Good." And there the matter appeared to have rested. He knocked on the inner door, but was not answered. Instead, the voice continued, "I'm very glad you asked me that, Mrs. Rawlinson. The term holistic refers to my conviction that what we are concerned with here is the fundamental interconnectedness of all things. I do not concern myself with such petty things as fingerprint powder, telltale pieces of pocket fluff, and inane footprints. I see the solution to each problem as being detectable in the pattern and web of the whole. The connections between causes and effects are often much more subtle and complex than we, with our rough and ready understanding of the physical world, might naturally suppose, Mrs. Rawlinson. Let me give you an example. If you go to an acupuncturist with toothache, he sticks a needle instead into your thigh. Do you know why he does that, Mrs. Rawlinson?" "No, neither do I, Mrs. Rawlinson, but we intend to find out. A pleasure talking to you, Mrs. Rawlinson. Goodbye." Another phone was ringing as he put this down. Richard eased the door open and looked in. It was the same Svlad, or Dirk, Celi. Looking a little rounder about the middle, a little looser and redder about the eyes and the neck, but it was still essentially the same face that he remembered most vividly, smiling a grim smile as its owner climbed into the back of one of the Black Marias of the Cambridgeshire Constabulary 8 years previously. He wore a heavy old light brown suit, which looked as if it had been worn extensively for bramble-hacking expeditions in some distant and better past. A red checked shirt, which failed entirely to harmonise with the suit, and a green striped tie, which refused to speak to either of them. He also wore thick metal-rimmed spectacles, which probably accounted at least in part for his dress sense. "Ah, Mrs. Bluthal, how thoroughly uplifting to hear from you," he was saying. "I was so distressed to hear that Miss Tiddles has passed over. This is desperate news indeed, and yet, should we allow black despair to hide from us the fairy light in which your blessed Moggy now forever dwells? I think not. Hark, I think I hear Miss Tiddles meowing e'en now. She calls to you, Mrs. Bluthal. She says she is content. She is at peace. She says she will be even more at peace when you've paid some bill or other. Does that ring a bell with you at all, Mrs. Bluthal? Come to think of it, I think I sent you one myself, not 3 months ago. I wonder if it can be that which is disturbing her eternal rest." Dirk beckoned Richard in with a brisk wave and then motioned him to pass the crumpled pack of French cigarettes that was sitting just out of his reach. "Sunday night, then, Mrs. Bluthal, Sunday night at 8:30. You know the address? Yes, I'm sure Miss Tiddles will appear, as I'm sure will your checkbook. Till then, Mrs. Bluthal, till then." Another phone was already ringing as he got rid of Mrs. Bluthal. He grabbed at it, lighting his crumpled cigarette at the same time. "Ah, Mrs. Sorskind," he said in answer to the caller. "My oldest and, may I say, most valued client. Good day to you, Mrs. Sorskind. Good day. Sadly, no sign as yet of young Roderick, I'm afraid, but the search is intensifying as it moves into what I am confident are its closing stages, and I'm sanguine that within mere days from today's date we will have the young rascal permanently restored to your arms and mewing prettily. Ah, yes, the bill, I was wondering if you had received it." Dirk's crumpled cigarette turned out to be too crumpled to smoke, so he hooked the phone onto his shoulder and poked around in the packet for another, but it was empty. He rummaged on his desk for a piece of paper and a stub of pencil, and wrote a note, which he passed to Richard. "Yes, Mrs. Sorskind," he assured the telephone, "I am listening with the utmost attention." The note said, "Tell Secretary, get Sigs." "Yes," continued Dirk into the phone, "but as I have endeavoured to explain to you, Mrs. Sorskind, over the 7 years of our acquaintance, I incline to the quantum mechanical view in this matter. My theory is that your cat is not lost, but that his waveform has temporarily collapsed and must be restored, Schrödinger, Planck, and so on." Richard wrote on the note, "You haven't got Secretary," and pushed it back. Dirk considered this for a while, then wrote, "Damn and blast," on the paper, and pushed it to Richard again. "I grant you, Mrs. Sorskind," continued Dirk blithely, "that 19 years is, shall we say, a distinguished age for a cat to reach, yet can we allow ourselves to believe that a cat such as Roderick has not reached it? And should we now, in the autumn of his years, abandon him to his fate? This surely is the time that he most needs the support of our continuing investigations. This is the time that we should redouble our efforts, and with your permission, Mrs. Sorskind, that is what I intend to do. Imagine, Mrs. Sorskind, how you would face him if you had not done this simple thing for him." Richard fidgeted with the note, shrugged himself, and wrote, "I'll get them" on it, and passed it back once more. Dirk shook his head in admonition, then wrote, "I couldn't possibly, that would be most kind." As soon as Richard had read this, Dirk took the note back and added, "Get money from Secretary" to it. Richard looked at the paper thoughtfully, took the pencil, and put a tick next to where he had previously written, "You haven't got Secretary." He pushed the paper back across the table to Dirk, who merely glanced at it and ticked, "I couldn't possibly, that would be most kind." "Well, perhaps," continued Dirk to Mrs. Sorskind, "you could just run over any of the areas in the bill that cause you difficulty, just the broader areas." Richard let himself out. Running down the stairs, he passed a young hopeful in a denim jacket and close-cropped hair, peering anxiously up the stairwell. "Hey, any good, mate?" he said to Richard. "Amazing," murmured Richard, "just amazing." He found a nearby newsagent's and picked up a couple of packets of Dix Blur for Dirk and a copy of the new edition of Personal Computer World, which had a picture of Gordon Way on the front. "Oh, pity about him, isn't it?" said the newsagent. "What? Yes," said Richard. He often thought the same himself, but was surprised to find his feelings so widely echoed. He picked up a Guardian as well, paid and left. Dirk was still on the phone, with his feet on the table, when Richard returned, and it was clear that he was relaxing into his negotiations. "Yes, expenses were, well, expensive in the Bahamas, Mrs. Sorskind. It is in the nature of expenses to be so, hence the name." He took the proffered packets of cigarettes, seemed disappointed there were only two, but briefly raised his eyebrows to Richard in acknowledgement of the favour he had done him, then waved him to a chair. The sounds of an argument conducted partly in French drifted down from the floor above. "Of course I will explain to you again why the trip to the Bahamas was so vitally necessary," said Dirk gently, soothingly. "Nothing could give me greater pleasure. I believe, as you know, Mrs. Sorskind, in the fundamental interconnectedness of all things. Furthermore, I have plotted and triangulated the vectors of the interconnectedness of all things and traced them to a beach in the Bahamas, which it is therefore necessary for me to visit from time to time in the course of my investigations. I wish it were not the case, and sadly, I am allergic to both sun and rum punches. But then, we all have our crosses to bear, do we not, Mrs. Sorskind?" A babble seemed to break out from the phone. "You sadden me, Mrs. Sorskind. I wish I could find it in my heart to tell you that I find your scepticism rewarding and invigorating, but with the best will in the world, I cannot. I am drained by it, Mrs. Sorskind, drained. I think you will find an item in the bill to the effect. Let me see." He picked up a flimsy carbon copy lying near him. "Detecting and triangulating the vectors of interconnectedness of all things, £150, we've dealt with that. Tracing same to beach and Bahamas, fare and accommodation, a mere £1,500. The accommodation was, of course, distressingly modest. Ah, yes, here we are, struggling on in the face of draining scepticism from client. Drinks, £327.50. Would that I did not have to make such charges, my dear Mrs. Sorskind. Would that the occasion did not continually arise. Not believing in my methods only makes my job more difficult, Mrs. Sorskind, and hence, regrettably, more expensive." Upstairs, the sounds of argument were becoming more heated by the moment. The French voice seemed to be verging on hysteria. "I do appreciate, Mrs. Sorskind," continued Dirk, "that the cost of the investigation has strayed somewhat from the original estimate, but I'm sure you will in your turn appreciate that a job which takes 7 years to do must clearly be more difficult than one that can be pulled off in an afternoon, and must therefore be charged at a higher rate. I have continually to revise my estimate of how difficult the task is, in the light of how difficult it has so far proved to be." The babble from the phone became more frantic. "My dear Mrs. Sorskind, or may I call you Joyce? Very well, then, my dear Mrs. Sorskind, let me say this. Do not worry yourself about the bill. Do not let it alarm or discomfort you. Do not, I beg you, let it become a source of anxiety to you. Just grit your teeth and pay it. He pulled his feet down off the table and leaned forward over the desk, inching the telephone receiver inexorably back towards its cradle. "As always, the very greatest pleasure to speak with you, Mrs. Sorskind. For now, goodbye." He at last put down the receiver, picked it up again, and dropped it for the moment into the wastepaper basket. "My dear Richard Macduff," he said, producing a large flat box from under his desk and pushing it across the table at him, "your pizza." Richard stared back in astonishment. No thanks," he said. "I had breakfast. Please, you have it." Dirk shrugged. "I told him he'd pop in and settle up over the weekend," he said. "Welcome, by the way, to my offices." He waved a vague hand around the tatty surroundings. "The light works," he said, indicating the window. "The gravity works," he said, dropping a pencil on the floor. "Anything else we have to take our chances with?" Richard cleared his throat. "What," he said, "is this?"
"What is what?"
"This," exclaimed Richard, "all this. You appear to have a holistic detective agency, and I don't even know what one is." "I provide a service that is unique in the world," said Dirk. "The term holistic refers to my conviction that what we are concerned with here is the fundamental interconnectedness of..." "Yes, I got that bit earlier," said Richard. "I have to say that it sounded a bit like an excuse for exploiting gullible old ladies." "Exploiting?" asked Dirk. "Well, I suppose it would be if anybody ever paid me, but I do assure you, my dear Richard, that there never seems to be the remotest danger of that. I live in what are known as hopes. I hope for fascinating and remunerative cases. My secretary hopes that I will pay her. Her landlord hopes that she will produce some rent. The electricity board hopes that he will settle their bill, and so on. I find it a wonderfully optimistic way of life. Meanwhile, I give a lot of charming and silly old ladies something to be happily cross about, and virtually guarantee the freedom of their cats. Is there, you ask, and I put the question for you, because I know you know I hate to be interrupted, is there a single case that exercises the tiniest part of my intellect, which, as you hardly need me to tell you, is prodigious? No. But do I despair? Am I downcast? Yes. Until," he added, "today." "Oh, well, I'm glad of that," said Richard. "But what was all that rubbish about cats and quantum mechanics?" With a sigh, Dirk flipped open the lid of the pizza with a single flick of practiced fingers. He surveyed the cold round thing with a kind of sadness, and then tore off a hunk of it. Pieces of pepperoni and anchovy scattered over his desk. "I am sure, Richard," he said, "that you are familiar with the notion of Schrödinger's cat," and he stuffed the larger part of the hunk into his mouth.
Of course," said Richard, "well, reasonably familiar."
"What is it?" said Dirk, through a mouthful. Richard shifted in his seat. "It's an illustration," he said, "of the principle that at a quantum level all events are governed by probabilities." "At a quantum level, and therefore at all levels," interrupted Dirk, "though at any level higher than the subatomic, the cumulative effect of those probabilities is, in the normal course of events, indistinguishable from the effect of hard and fast physical laws. Continue." He put some more cold pizza into his face. Richard reflected that Dirk's was a face into which too much had already been put. What with that and the amount he talked, the traffic through his mouth was almost incessant. His ears, on the other hand, remained almost totally unused in normal conversation. It occurred to Richard that if Lamarck had been right, and you were to take a line through this behaviour for several generations, the chances were that some radical replumbing of the interior of the skull would eventually take place. Richard continued, "Not only are quantum-level events governed by probabilities, but those probabilities aren't even resolved into actual events until they are measured, or, to use a phrase I just heard you use in a rather bizarre context, the act of measurement collapses the probability waveform. Up until that point, all the possible courses of action open to, say, an electron coexist as probability waveforms. Nothing is decided until it's measured." Dirk nodded. "More or less," he said, taking another mouthful. "But what of the cat?"